Welcome to Little Atoms on Resonance 104.4 FM, a live talk show based around ideas of the Enlightenment.
Little Atoms is presented by Neil Denny, Padraig Reedy, Richard Saunderson, and Rebecca Watson, as well as regular mystery guest presenters.
Little Atoms makes no claims to balance. We actively promote science, freedom of expression, skepticism, and secular humanism. This means we can often end up talking about superstition, religious fundamentalism, censorship, and conspiracy theory.
Our guests bring ideas that are challenging, sometimes controversial, often polemical, but always interesting. Good evening, welcome to another Little Atoms. Tonight with me, Neil Denny, and with Richard Saunderson, and we're welcoming back Philippe Legrain to the show, and Richard's going to introduce Philippe now.
Thanks, Neil. Philippe Legrain is a journalist and writer based in London, but interested in the whole world. He's fascinated by how economics, politics and culture combine to form the big picture, and how the world is coming together through globalisation, while becoming ever more diverse through cultural mixing and individual choice. Philippe writes primarily about globalisation, migration and European issues. But through this, his blog and his contributions to The Guardian's Comment is Free is now ranging more widely. Philippe is also a contributing editor to Prospect, and as of September 2007 is a visiting fellow at the European Institute of the London School of Economics. He followed up his first book, Open World, The Truth About Globalisation, with a second, Immigrants, Your Country Needs Them, making the case for a freer international migration policy. His latest is Aftershock, Reshaping the World Economy After the Crisis. Philippe, welcome to Little Atoms.
Welcome, it's good to be back.
I can't really let we'll obviously talk about the book primarily on the show, but I can't let last week's events go by without us mentioning it, because you read an interesting article, I think for The Guardian, which I read this morning in March about the election, in which you were suggesting that for those of us of what you describe as a progressive bent, this actually might be a good election for us to lose. Now, in my opinion, we did. Although, as I dare say, the people, our new incumbents, would describe themselves as progressive. What's your take on it?
Right. The starting point for that article was comparison between now and 1992. If you look back at it, thank goodness Labour didn't win in 92, because the Sterling ERM crisis would still have happened. And that would have shredded Labour's reputation for economic competence. And probably within 5 years, the Tories would have been back. Instead, they won. They got ever more unpopular. There was scandal after scandal. They had the ERM crisis, and that paved the way for 13 years of Labour government. And personally, I think that, you know, nearly everyone I spoke to was saying, even diehard Labour supporters, well, you know, we might just vote Labour because we always do and we ought to, but no one was enthusiastic about it. And the mood of the country at large was just simply, you know, sick to the back teeth of Labour. And therefore, with, on top of that, an economic crisis, the risk of a run on the pound, an echo of 1992, mm-hmm. the nastiest cuts, you know, ever to be made by any government, particularly nasty for, you know, any Labour minister who's spent the past 13 years increasing public spending, delivering on, you know, everything that they find dear, and then having to, you know, cut it all back. That it seemed to me this was an election that was won.
Let
that,
somebody else have the responsibility for doing all that cutting,
and mainly, you know, have 5 years to kind of renew yourself in opposition. And I think, you know, I stand by that. I think that it actually the big winner, even more so than I anticipated, because I anticipated a Tory victory, not a Libcom coalition. I wasn't that. I didn't have that much foresight.
I don't think many people did.
No,
including many
not.
People who voted for the Lib Dems.
Sure, of course, it's a complete novelty. But I think that just only that makes it even really, from a Labour point of view, makes it even better. I mean, you know, there's now no opposition at all to the government apart from the Labour Party. There is no alternative to anyone on the left or centre-left, really, realistically, apart from the Labour Party. And the next 5 years are going to be gruesome. At the end of it, I think, you know, the Lib Dems are going to be squeezed out, and it's going to be a straight fight between Tory and Labour. And therefore, provided, you know, Labour doesn't fall apart in opposition, stands a very good chance of winning in 5 years' time.
Which isn't impossible,
let's face it. Of course it could happen. Of course, you know, they're risk to anything. But you know, I think it's, from a Labour point of view, actually this new coalition is probably a good thing.
Absolutely. Well, let's dive into Aftershock then, and perhaps towards the end of the show we can sort of come back to the election and perhaps look at ways in which, you know, some of the things that you talk about and recommend might be affected by, you know, by the government, or, you know, more likely might not. But perhaps we should start off, before we really dive into the book, let's talk about what actually happened, just in case, you know, anybody who's been living under a rock for the last couple of years. You know, we're still in the midst of a, you know, massive global meltdown. At the beginning of the book, you use Iceland as a sort of example of what happened. So perhaps let's look at what happened in Iceland.
Yeah, well, I think Iceland is kind of an extreme example of what happened in Britain, in Ireland, in Spain, and in the United States. And it's also a warning, because, you know, if you want to see what a depression's like, you don't need to travel back in time. You just, you know, volcano ash permitting, it's 3 hours flight north. And they are experiencing a depression. I mean, the houses have halved in value, the currency is halved in value, the stock market's down 90%, consumer spending is down by a third, and government spending is down by a third. I mean, you know, it's really back to the 1930s for them. And then people say, well, you know, Iceland, you know, it's a funny, tiny little place, and, you know, its population is smaller than Camden and Islington. They have quirky people like Bjork. It's not really a serious place. And then you look actually at the figures and you see, well, you know, Iceland's banks grew so big that their assets, mostly dodgy assets, were 9 times bigger than their economy. And in the case of Britain, our banks, with equally dodgy assets, grew to be 5.5 times the size of the economy. RBS, Royal Bank of Scotland alone, 166% of GDP, massive. And then, so when Gordon Brown stepped in to save the banks, he in effect pledged all our future incomes as collateral against those losses. And the gamble paid off. We didn't plunge into depression. But if we had plunged into depression, we would have been stuck with an Icelandic-sized bill. And it's absolutely massive. You know, the IceSave alone, many people put money into IceSave. When IceSave went bust, you know, the UK and Dutch governments have gone after the money from the Icelandic government. And that, the bill for that alone is £11,000 for every man, woman and child. So you think a family of four, that's 44 grand to pay for the collapse of one bank. So, you know, that for me, it says what happens if the banks, which are deemed too big to fail, in fact prove too big to save.
Let's look at what's going to happen with the banks in the future then, because you obviously, you know, there are things already happening. You know, the governments around the world have put in place plans to, first of all, bulk up the money of the banks and then sort of, you know, a little tiny bit of reform. But basically, first of all, you talk about how this isn't enough, but perhaps we should talk about what you think they should be doing. How should we be reforming the banks then, do you think, stop this happening again?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, basically what's happened is a racket. I mean, the banks have racked up huge losses, and those losses have been passed on to taxpayers. So, and now, with government guarantees, they are borrowing for zero from the Bank of England, buying either government bonds or riskier assets, and making loads of money, knowing that if the bets go wrong, we stand to pick up the losses. And that's immoral, and it's incredibly dangerous because it paves the way for another crisis. You know, if you think about it, you know, they've got nothing to lose. They might as well gamble to high heaven. So then you look at what most governments are proposing, and they're looking at changes in regulation. They're looking at how to make banks safer, you know, make them hold more capital so they're less risky. But they're not actually looking at the fundamental problem, which is, well, you know, unless we break out of this system where banks are not allowed to fail, that we're going to run into this problem again, and the consequences could be terrible. And that's why I think we need to go one step further. We need to set up mechanisms, first of all, so that they can, you know, go bankrupt like any other company. But secondly, we need to break the huge financial power that they have. In boom times, they make monopoly profits, which they say is a contribution to society, but actually is a cost to society. And in bust, they foot us with the bill. And so what do we need to do? We need to break them up. We need to, first of all, set competition watchdogs on them and say, you know, where are you making monopoly profits and how is the best way to cut them? And we need to break their financial power so that come another crisis, they cannot blackmail politicians and the rest of the country and say, give us the money or else.
So let's talk about how we go about doing that then. How do you think, what's the most...
Well, I mean, governments have done it before. I mean, that's the thing. In 1933, Franklin Roosevelt faced down J.P. Morgan. At the time, the House of Morgan was, you know, far bigger than any bank is now. It completely dominated the U.S. banking system and the U.S. economy. And Franklin Roosevelt had the guts to break it up. And, you know, I think that in the United States, Barack Obama has to do similar things, and we in Britain do too. Now, Vince Cable has made noises about that, and therefore it's a positive thing that he's in, he's in the government. It looks like he's actually not responsible for banking after all, George Osborne is, and despite the growls that the Tories made against the banks during the election campaign, which they had to do to get elected, I don't think it's credible that they're a credible anti-bank party. So you have to kind of hope against hope that it doesn't take a second crisis before we finally face down their power.
But in some respects, I mean, the fact that Cable might even be something of a voice in there is actually more than what was going on before. I mean, the Labour Party would definitely didn't have any plans to break up the banks.
Sure. No, I think Labour on this have been absolutely terrible. I think they've been... you listen to Gordon Brown's speeches from a few years back, and he was singing the praises of the city, and, you know, no wonder it looked like the golden goose. You can pay for a Scandinavian welfare state without having to put up taxes. It looks perfect from a social democratic politician's point of view. And even now, after the crisis hit, still seem to believe that what was good for the city was good for Britain, and didn't quite dare call the banker's bluff and say, actually, we need to change things. Hopefully, you know, have to hope that Vince Cable will influence this government to do that. The European Union has some say. They've already, you know, forced some European banks to sell off some assets. But fundamentally, I think it has to come from national governments. Barack Obama could set the lead in the United States. He is sounding much tougher now. And, you know, fingers crossed it doesn't take another crisis for it finally to happen.
Now, we're talking about banking, and it's quite understandable to think banking, think capitalism. But of course, banking itself and, you know, the financial markets themselves are only sort of one piece of the pie. So perhaps let's widen this out and look at how you talk about ways in which we could regulate the world economic system, really.
Well, I think the thing, you need to make a very clear distinction between financial markets and other markets. Mm-hmm. As an engine of creating new technologies, capitalism is incredibly successful. You just have to look in the midst of the worst recessions of the 1930s. There are new smartphones coming out all the time. Google's bringing out, you know, one product launch after another. Even now, as an engine of new technology, it's succeeding. As an engine of also spreading wealth to developing countries, at least in recent decades, has been also astonishingly successful. One of the big things in the book is looking at the rise of China, India, other countries. Absolutely astonishing. Living standards in China have multiplied by 10 since 1980. They've doubled since the turn of the century alone. So in that respect, you know, it's been incredibly successful. The big problem that there's been, and it's kind of the flip side of the financial crisis, is that finance and the property market has grown so big that it's crowded out the rest of the economy. And it means that investment that might have poured into high tech or manufacturing or all sorts of other things has gone into unproductive things like bricks and mortar and financial innovation, which looked like it was productive but actually proved not to be. And therefore, we need to reshape our own economy and the world economy to make it fairer, to make it balanced, to make it healthier and more sustainable. And I think that starts in Britain by breaking our addiction to property speculation. And what does that mean? It means that, first of all, we need to build many more houses. Second of all, when banks are lending too much, the regulators need to step in to prevent them doing so. And third of all, and this is really important in the context of also the biggest budget deficit the country's ever faced, is a land tax. You know, it's astonishing. Labour went into this election claiming that the best way to fill the deficit was to raise taxes on labour. you know, and I think forget about the Tories' alternative and the efficiency savings. Just it's astonishing that at a time of high unemployment, when incomes are squeezed, that a Labour government thinks the best way to fill the deficit is to raise taxes on labour. And I think, no, what we should be doing is we should be cutting taxes on labour, and we should be introducing a tax on land values.
Could you just explain to us what a land tax is and exactly, you know, how land is valued? Because this has confused me slightly.
All right. Well, I mean, you know, land is valued all the time. That's what the estate agents and surveyors basically do. And you can, with a computer program and with data from property sales in any area, you can calculate the value of land easily. The Land Registry does it. The Barker Report in 2004 for the government did it. It's really not rocket science at all. The point about assessing it on land rather than property is that it doesn't discourage development. If you tax property, then, you know, if someone turns a derelict site into, you know, social housing or, you know, a new shopping centre, then they're going to be taxed on that. The point about a land tax is that you're taxing the land and not the development of it. And why is that a good thing? Well, because when you tax labour, well, it costs jobs, first of all. It lowers incomes and it causes some people to either not work at all or work less hard. You tax land, it's in fixed supply. You know, it's not. It can't disappear. It can't go off to a tax haven. So, in economic terms, that makes it efficient, less damaging to growth. It's also stabilising, as I said, because it limits property bubbles, and you could raise the tax when, you know, property prices are rising fast to try and, you know, stop these. This endless cycle of bubble and bust, which we've had, you know, we had it in the 80s as well. It's like, it's the British addiction. And thirdly, it's fair, and that's really, really, really important, because land in Britain is incredibly unequally distributed. It's less, you know, more unequally, in fact, than in Brazil. There, 1% of the population owns 49% of the land, and here, 0.3% own 69% of Britain. And most of these people are hereditary landowners. They're people like the Duke of Buccleuch, whose ancestors seized 277,000 acres of Scotland. That's 277,000 football pitches by basically evicting the people who were there.
And they just see the money rolling in.
And who's now the British, now Britain's biggest landowner. And he's not taxed. He gets handouts from the Common Agricultural Policy instead. Or you look at the Duke of Westminster, who got 300 acres of fields. In what is now central London, it's become Mayfair and Belgravia. They've skyrocketed from being almost worthless to being worth £6.5 billion. And that land rises in value each year, not because landowners are working hard or investing in it. It rises in value because people have moved to London and worked hard and increased the value of that land. And surely, therefore, we should be taxing the windfall gain rather than the hard work of the people who generate that gain.
You're listening to Little Atoms with me, Neil Denny, and Richard Sanderson, and we're talking to Philippe Legrain about his new book, Aftershock, Reshaping the World Economy After the Crisis. Now, Philippe, you've already raised the giant dragon of China. One of the themes in the book is how, in the way that I've just done, people are actually, in some ways, scared of the emerging economies. China, India, Korea, Brazil, etc., you know, that are coming up. And there's various reasons for this, but perhaps we should first of all just talk about why. Why do you think there's that sort of strange sort of atavistic fear of the rise of these economies?
Well, I think partly it's obviously a matter of size. I mean, the mind boggles at thinking there's a country of 1.3 billion people, or in India's case, it's 1.1 billion. You know, all of Europe is 500 million, and we think 60, you know, you can scarcely think in those kind of big numbers. So that's part of it. Clearly, obviously, some of it is a kind of nationalist stroke kind of racist thing. And then, you know, a lot of it is basically fear that China's going to steal all our jobs. And it's true, clearly, that China's having a big impact on the world economy, and that that means that, you know, to a certain extent, some people are losing their jobs. But it's also the biggest export market of the future. At a time now when, you know, British consumer spending is flat on its feet, American consumer spending, which is the engine of the economy before, also flat on its feet, China's consumer market is growing by 16% a year. It's now the biggest market for cars. It's now the biggest market for mobile phones. Chinese tourists are becoming as ubiquitous, or they'll soon be as ubiquitous as Japanese ones. And you say, well, actually, You know, where are jobs going to come from in the future? They're going to come from selling to China, to India, to Korea, to Indonesia, to Brazil, to South Africa, and all these emerging economies. And if you think about it, there are about 1 billion people in the world who are living in desperately poor countries in Africa and elsewhere who have really serious problems. There are 1 billion people who are in rich countries, and there are 4 billion in between who are, you know, rising very quickly. And that's fantastic for them. Anyone who cares about social justice should be really happy that the Industrial Revolution is spreading its benefits, you know, outside from a privileged few to, you know, the vast majority of humanity. But it's also good for us because it's a new market. And it's also creating new technologies. I mean, it's amazing. China is still a much poorer country than we are, and yet they're at the forefront of creating electric cars, for example. India is at the forefront of wind technology. So they're also contributing new technologies which benefit us.
And as they're both green things as well, which is, of course, one of the main worries people have about the developing countries becoming more industrialised.
Sure, and that's another big topic in the book. And, you know, if the climate scientists are correct, climate change could have absolutely catastrophic consequences. And therefore, we need to take action to try to limit temperature rises and to mitigate the damage from them. And, you know, governments need to put a price on carbon, and they need to encourage investment in green technologies. But one of the key messages of the book is that the solution to climate change is not to kind of retreat into the dark ages, to be giving up on the comforts of modern life, still less trying to be denying them to people in China and India. First of all, because, again, what right do we have to, you know, we live our nice cozy lives and say to them, no, you can't have what we have.
Or by reducing our population by a third, which I saw you in an extraordinary discussion with somebody talking along those lines.
Or, in any case, we're not going to stop them, moving from acquiring these things. But more importantly, you know, the right answer to this is to change the energy source. You know, it's to tap the power of solar energy, wind energy, atomic energy. It's to find new ways, and these things are already being developed, of creating plastics from plants, of running cars on ethanol made from sugarcane waste. And what really matters is not oil, gas, and coal are just a means to an end. What really matters are all the fantastic things it permits. Whether it is an escape from drudgery in the home, whether it's the ability to travel and see the world and broaden your horizons, and so on. And I'm optimistic. I went to Silicon Valley as part of the research for the book, and you see this incredible sort of meeting of minds. You see entrepreneurs who go in there not to save the planet, but to make money, at the same time as, you know, people from China, from India, all sorts of bright sparks, all sorts of new companies being created. I took a spin at a Tesla electric car, which is amazing, 0 to 60 in 4 seconds. And yet it makes hardly any noise. It's clean, it's cool. And also, you know, the great thing, we'd be, you know, no more wars over oil, no more smog in cities, you know, huge benefits as well. So I mean, I'm optimistic about that. It does need government intervention. I'm not saying it's technologies on its own. We do need government intervention to set a price on carbon too.
Well, this is what I wanted to come to next. I mean, you sort of mentioned the idea of sort of carbon trading, and clearly, at the moment, there's an inequality, and that, you know, the West has taken historically that, you know, the vast majority of resources, and we're at a certain wealth level, and for the emerging economies to sort of catch up, presumably, so we don't punish them and prevent them from doing that, we in the West need to take a bigger chunk of the responsibility for reducing carbon. So how do we go about doing that?
Well, I think, you know, the ultimate aim, I suppose the only fair aim, is that by 2050, everyone should be consuming roughly the same amount of carbon per person. And that implies that the world needs to slash its emissions by about half, and that the rich countries need to slash them by about 80%. And in the case of developing countries who are growing fast, or emerging economies, it makes sense for them to make their cuts later, because they're growing so fast. Their living standards at the moment in China are doubling every 9 years. They'll quadruple in 18. It makes much more sense for them to make their cuts later rather than sooner. And we need At the same time, we need to provide technology and cash to the really poor countries to help them. At the same time, you know, China is incredibly wasteful, you know, in terms of its energy use, and it has a lot of scope to grow fast while also becoming much more efficient. And also, as like I said, it's also had lots of opportunity to leapfrog our technologies, to go straight, you know, to BYD developing electric cars, or Suzlon developing wind energy, and just leapfrog our technologies and go straight to green development.
Well, we're pretty much out of time, but just very quickly to finish, I wanted to talk about when you were on the show before, we talked about the book Immigrants, Why Our Country Needs Them. And I wanted to sort of bring in the idea of how the free movement of labour and the free movement of people sort of plays into ways in which, you know, we can develop the economy in the future and change things.
Sure. Well, I mean, you know, I think the free movement of people is a fantastic engine for freedom and for progress. You know, Tom Friedman wrote this book where he said the world is flat. And that's nonsense. The world is anything but flat. You know, the biggest determinant of your life chances is not how talented you are. It's not how hard you work. It's where you were born and who your parents were. And therefore, for me, setting people free to live and work where they want, as well as breaking down society barriers within society which hold people back, is crucial in terms of justice and in terms of progress.
You've been listening to Little Atoms with me, Neil Denny, and Richard Sanderson, and we've been talking to Philip Le Grain. So, Philip, thanks for coming on the show again.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot, Philip.
Cheers.
You've been listening to Little Atoms. You can find details of upcoming guests on our website, littleatoms.com. The Little Atoms podcast is available on iTunes. Thanks for listening.